topic this morning continues in the theme of the diet-behavior connection. And this morning it is spiritual development and mental vigor and breastfeeding. We have a very good example from the scriptures of that thing that we will be talking about this morning, and that is the influence of diet on spiritual development, on spiritual discernment, and on mental development and mental achievement. In the book of Daniel, chapter 1, we have the most striking story concerning this particular subject that we have anywhere in all of recorded history. What happened was that Daniel and a number of other youth from the royal household in Israel were taken captive up to Babylon. The diet of these captives was prescribed by the king himself, by the king of Babylon. I'll read chapter 1, verse 5. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's food and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, and at the end thereof they might stand before the king. In other words, they were to stand their board exams after they had had 3 years of their postgraduate education. But Daniel purposed in his heart, this is verse 8, that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse than the children which are of your sort? Then shall you make me endanger my head with the king. So then Daniel said, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to drink, to eat, and water to drink. See, he didn't want the rich food, he just wanted water and vegetables, or beans. Then let our countenances be looked upon. In other words, do a physical examination on us. And the children, and the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's meat, and judge. See, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. And as for these 4 children, that was Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, God gave them knowledge and skill and all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams, mental development and spiritual development and spiritual discernment on this good diet. There is the clearest scientific evidence today that the same principles that Daniel lived by in his day still influence the development of mankind today. And that by taking a simple diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and a few nuts, that we can develop the same kind of mental superiority and spiritual discernment. Now listen to this. This is verse 18. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he would bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. In other words, they had a position given to them because of the excellence of their performance and their board exams. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And you'll remember that Daniel so discharged his duties in such a fine way that he is the only person in history that we have any record of who survived 3 empires. He went from the Babylonian to the Medo-Persian, well, to the Medes, to the Persians. He had all 3 of those different empires that he survived through. Apparently his services were of such an excellent nature that it was considered that the kingdom could not do without his services. Now, I have just given to you some reasons from a personal and professional standpoint why it would be good for you to have a good diet. Now I'd like to give you another. This comes from Councils on Diet and Food, a little book which some of you may have with you. I believe we may have requested in our seminar brochure materials that you bring this little book with you if you have it. It's a fine little book. And the first 80 to 90 pages tell about the spiritual and mental achievements that are superior in those, or the promise of it, in those who are careful about the diet. If we are sick, we impose a weary tax upon our friends and unfit us for discharging our duties to our families and to our neighbors. What a very important reason for us to be healthy, so that we won't impart a weary tax on those who love us and who have to take care of us, or who have to do our duties if we are not there to perform them. Let it ever be kept before the mind that the great object of hygienic reform is to secure the highest possible development of mind, soul, and body. It is not just a rehearsal in self-control, nor is it any kind of penance that we might be going through. The objective of any kind of helpful practice is that we might be able to think, that we might be able to commune with God, that we might be able to be of service to one another, and that we might keep ourselves from being a burden and a tax on other people because of our having neglected ourselves and requiring money and time and care to take care of our needs during our sicknesses. Only when we are intelligent in regard to the principles of helpful living can we be fully aroused to see the evils resulting from an improper diet. You see, we cannot even discern what is going on wrong with us when we are on an unhelpful program. I often have patients tell me, "Dr. Thrash, I just don't understand it. I used to be able to sit down to a table having all manner of improper articles of diet on it and partake of it with freedom, and it never hurt me. I just got up and went about my duties, and nothing ever bothered me. And now, since I have been on this helpful diet for 2 years, I go back home and my mother prepares some things that are only mildly unhelpful, and I eat of it and I'm sick for 2 days. Can you explain that to me?" Well, here is the explanation. It is only when we are fully following the health reform that we can see the evils resulting from an improper diet. We adapt to these taxations on our physiologic systems, and we become unaware of them. Take the adaptation that you do to pepper. Pepper is a common item of diet in American menus. Most people who use pepper regularly have no gastric distress from it. But just let them be off pepper for a while and then take a little pepper, and for 2 days they'll be having a stomach ache. That's because the stomach becomes sensitive to it again. Now, we have discussed why we have symptoms. Why do we have symptoms? We've discussed that in this class. It's to warn us that tissue is about to be injured. So if you have a stomach ache, what does that mean? Something is wrong. Tissue is about to be injured, or may already be injured. Those who, after seeing their mistakes, have courage to change their habits will find that the reformatory process requires a struggle and much upward perseverance. But when correct tastes are once formed, they will realize that the use of food which they formerly regarded as harmless was slowly and surely laying the foundation for indigestion and other diseases. Right physical habits promote mental superiority. Intellectual power, physical strength, and longevity depend upon immutable laws. What kind of laws? Immutable. What about man's laws? Are they immutable? Oh, yes, or you can, they are not immutable. We can break a traffic law, and if we're not caught, we'll get by, won't we? But what about these laws that involve our physical health? Can we break one of them and get by? No, you always pay. Always pay. We don't always realize that we pay, but that's because of the goodness of God. He has given us such an enormous bank account that if we pay out some, we don't realize that we've lost some until the time finally comes when we have no more reserves. And at that time, we begin to be sorry that we have been so wanton with our resources. There is no happen-so, no chance about this matter. And so I would like for you to recognize that although you may have been thinking that you were getting by with the taxes and so forth that you have been having to pay because of broken health law, you really are not getting by. You're having a problem that you just have not discerned yet. Now, I'd like for us to go back a bit in our discussion to the time when a person is just born, in the newborn period, and discuss the diet and how the diet influences the kind of mind that you have now. The custom of breastfeeding is coming back in again, having been out for about, 40 years? Yeah, 20 to 40 years. I can remember 50 years ago when it was very common for women to breastfeed their babies. And you might see a mother anywhere, even in public, breastfeeding her babies. It was not considered at all immodest nor out of the way a bit for a woman to be breastfeeding her babies right out in public. Of course, she was usually rather discreet about the matter, but it was certainly not anything that was considered something to be embarrassed about at all. This practice is coming back in again. Not very long ago, I was in an airport, I think it was in New York, and a mother who had twins and was transporting them from the place they had been born in New York to another place down farther south, she and her mother-in-law and her husband were traveling together with the twins. During the time that we were sitting there in the waiting room, one of the twins needed to be fed. So the mother just breastfed the baby right there in the airport. They were very well-to-do, appearing people. And I think that the witness of this young mother to just witness to the fact that she was determined to breastfeed her babies and that she would do so right there, take care of the needs of her child right there, I thought that was a very fine thing. Breastfed infants have a number of advantages over non-breastfed babies, and I would like to discuss some of these with you. Mothers also have a great number of advantages, and one of those is that she regains her figure better after the birth of the baby. There are contractions that are set up in the uterus that bring the uterus back down to a smaller size, and any woman who has done breastfeeding is quite well aware of the activity that goes on in the uterus during the time that she is breastfeeding the infant. It is an almost unknown thing to find a subinvoluted uterus in a woman who has done breastfeeding at the 6 weeks checkup. It is a common thing to find subinvolution of the uterus in a woman who has been bottle feeding her babies. Subinvolution is the inadequate return to the normal size in the uterus. Now, another thing that is an advantage is that during the time that a woman is breastfeeding, she will usually not have menstrual periods. The absence of menstrual periods greatly cuts down on her fertility, which means that she is unlikely to have another baby during the time that she is breastfeeding that infant. And since most women breastfeed their babies for at least a year, some for 14 or 16 months, that means that it's probably about 2 years before she will have another baby if she just allows nature to take its course. What a blessing that is, It is certainly a curse to a woman to have a small infant in her arms year after year after year, isn't it? And if one just lets nature take its course, it certainly is a very great provision if nature has made it so that a woman would not have another baby when she has one already in diapers. Now, one of the advantages in not having so many menstrual periods is that the total number of menstrual periods that a woman has during her reproductive life determines to some degree her risk of getting cancer of the breast. And so breastfeeding protects against cancer of the breast. So this is another advantage for the mother. And I consider one of the finest advantages of breastfeeding the convenience of breastfeeding. It is also somewhat cheaper, and for those who have that as one of the nice things of life, that of economy, you will find that that the economy is also a feature of breastfeeding. But the convenience of breastfeeding is that the breast milk is always sterile, it is always warm, always ready, always available wherever the mother is. Another advantage is that when the mother is breastfeeding, she must actually sit down herself to breastfeed the baby. And that very sitting down is a great help to the mother. She needs to sit down and put aside all of her cares and just concentrate her mind on the baby for a while. And this relaxation is a great help against such distressing things as postpartum psychoses and the fatigue that plague many women following childbirth. It takes a full year for a woman's body to return to normal after childbirth, and we recommend breastfeeding as one of those things that hastens this return to normal. Her psychological outlook also requires some little while before she can fully get back to the normal outlook on life that she has had in the pre-pregnancy stage. And breastfeeding is one of those things that assists with that. Now let's take some of the advantages to the baby. One of the things is a stimulus to the hormone systems of the baby and an increase in blood sugar. And this occurs even in the first few hours of life. One of the first things that a baby wants to do after he is born is to nurse. But that reflex lasts only about half an hour. And often a baby will not nurse during the first 24 hours except during his first half an hour. And the first 10 minutes of that half an hour is the time when his stimulus to suck is the most strong. Why do you suppose that is? Well, it's because the mother needs it. And our divine designer designed it so that the baby would be born wanting to suck, wanting to nurse. And so if the baby is presented to the breast, often the baby will have a very vigorous suck reflex right at that point. And what does that do for the uterus? It causes the uterus to contract. What advantage is that after 10 minutes of postpartum period? It stops the bleeding. And so she presents the baby to the breast. The very psychological effect of presenting the baby to the breast, even if the baby does not nurse, will cause the uterus to contract, because psychological factors also involved in even thinking of the baby will make the uterus contract. Isn't that an interesting phenomenon? As I said before, there is not a place where our Heavenly Father has left anything out. Everything, to the last minute detail, has been planned for our successful existence here on this earth. Now, the baby needs this physiologic boost to his hormone system and to his blood sugar. Human breast milk contains a strong growth-stimulating substance which encourages the baby's brain growth. There are two substances, one called cysteine. Cysteine is an amino acid present in large quantity in mother's milk, not present in much of a large quantity at all. In fact, it's almost absent from cow's milk. Almost absent. Cysteine is a strong stimulus to brain cell growth. Cows don't need that because they don't have a very big brain. At full grown, their brains will not be the size that a baby's brain is at birth. And yet the animal will weigh 10 times as much as the human does, but his brain is just a tiny little brain. We need that stimulus to brain growth. Cow's milk is far from appropriate for a baby human. The calcium content of cow's milk is 3 to 4 times as high as human milk, and we have discussed set points for humans in this class before. Set points for such things as weight and height and growth rates, and these are partly controlled by the diet, in large measure, controlled by the diet. If the baby is given this milk that is not suited for him, a human baby will grow in a different way, at a different rate, and various parts of the body will be stimulated to grow that we don't need to have stimulated to grow at that time. But a calf does, because a calf has altogether different requirements than a human does. A calf will be walking in just a few minutes after he is born, but not so with a baby human. It requires months for a baby human to get to the point where he is going to walk, because it isn't an important thing for a baby human to walk right away. It is an important thing for the baby human's brain to start developing right away. By the end of the first year of the baby's life, the baby should be in a position where the baby understands everything that is said to him. He cannot vocalize in response, but he can make some responses. He can make psychological and emotional responses to what is said to him. He can often obey. He can, in fact, he indubitably can obey. Before he is a month old, the baby should be able to obey quite nicely. This complex of amino acids and even trace metals and minerals cannot be duplicated in formula milk, not in any way. Now, only breast milk should be given to a child until the child is 6 months of age. Even water need not be administered to a child because of the fact that even during fevers or hot weather, mother's milk will usually provide sufficient water. A wise mother can observe her infant and decide whether or not some water might be needed to supplement the water of the breast milk. But the first part of breast milk is watery, and that satisfies the baby's thirst right away. And the last part of breast milk is quite rich, quite fatty. That milk is needed to quench the baby's appetite. So if the baby is thirsty or has a fever, the mother should give the baby the top of both breasts. But if the baby is thin and needs to grow more, then she should allow the baby to completely empty one breast before she presents the other breast, since the last part of the feeding will be more rich than the first part. Now notice also that this particular thing will have a very nice suppression of the appetite for the baby. Rich foods suppress the appetite. And so a breastfed baby learns another thing that will help him with his set point, and that is how to operate the automatic cutoff of appetite. When the richness of the food that one has eaten reaches the point that one should shut off one's appetite, the breastfed baby will have been accustomed to do so from his very first eating experiences. Do you understand that? All right, so you see that there are many advantages to breastfeeding. Now, all infants on cow's milk have circulating antibodies against cow's milk and against cow's protein. All bottle-fed babies, that's 100%. Now, this is an indication to us, the presence of these antibodies is an indication to us that there is a resistance of the body against receiving the cow's milk. And therefore, babies bottle-fed are much more likely to have infantile eczema and colic, two very distressing disorders of infancy. Infantile eczema is a breaking out, weeping lesion from the scalp right down to the soles. And these poor little infants sit there with their cracking skin. Every time they move, their skin cracks and it weeps and oozes or even bleeds. These poor little miserable babies have 2 years of misery. And most of that could be avoided by breastfeeding. An occasional baby breastfed will have infantile eczema, but usually this represents cow's milk in the mother's diet. So if the mother will eliminate cow's milk from her diet, her child is far less likely to have that. Asthma and a runny nose, even psychological disturbances have been linked with the use of cow's milk. And we talked about the findings of Dr. Alexander Schaus, who found that juvenile delinquents on the average consumed 64 ounces of milk and cheese per day, whereas non-delinquent boys in the same geographic and socioeconomic levels consumed only 30. Of girls, it was 42 and 17, respectively, for delinquent and non-delinquent girls. In many instances, even if a mother drinks cow's milk, her baby will develop the same antibodies in the bloodstream and the same asthma and runny nose and psychological problems. A child is often launched on a lifetime of fighting allergies by early exposure to cow's milk. Then formula-fed babies have much less iron stores than have breastfed babies. Cow's milk contains very little iron. Mother's milk contains a little more, but baby doesn't need much in the way of iron because baby is born with a good bit of iron, has a lot of hemoglobin that he must break down in the first few days of life, that the fetal hemoglobin that we spoke of yesterday, fetal hemoglobin being 300 times more added in its holding on to oxygen, needed only for the moment of birth, and then fetal hemoglobin is broken down and is replaced by adult hemoglobin, so that by the end of the second year, all of the fetal hemoglobin should have been broken down and replaced by adult hemoglobin by that time. So iron stores are depleted by cow's milk. In fact, cow's milk actually causes bleeding from the gastrointestinal tract in many infants. There are fewer infections in babies who are breastfed, and one of the reasons for that is because of the fact that the cow's milk itself is infected, and another reason is because the mother's milk gives to the baby antibodies to fight these infections. Gastrointestinal disorders of all kinds, such as ulcerative colitis and peptic ulcer, these are less in breastfed babies. Some of you may know that even 8-month-old children can get peptic ulcers. Part of that is the stress of television played constantly in the home where a child is. A part of that is the bickering and busy lifestyle of our modern society. A part of that is the type of diet that the child gets. Mother's milk helps the baby not to develop high blood cholesterol. Both the mother and the infant can attain a more ideal weight if the infant is breastfed. I didn't mention an amino acid called taurine. Now, I did mention the fact that there is a sort of spectrum of chemicals in milk that are specific for the baby. Taurine is an amino acid which stimulates brain growth, but at the same time, it tends to suppress abnormal activity, abnormal electrical activity. Some cases of epilepsy are now known to be associated with agents that stimulate transmission of nerve impulses across the junctions between two nerves, and taurine has a suppressing influence on this excessive or abnormal transmission of electrical impulses. T-A-U-R-I-N-E, taurine. Sometimes you will hear it said that babies should not be given cow's milk, mother's milk, because some mothers have viral particles of breast cancer in their milk. And that is true. Some mothers do, a certain percentage, about 15%. But nobody ever says anything about the fact that 75% of samples of cow's milk have cancer virus particles in them. There is a 90% efficiency in converting calories that a mother eats to calories for her milk. So it is an inexpensive way of feeding. If she must produce 715 calories, she needs to eat only 786 calories to remain in balance. But most women would like to lose a little weight after they have had a pregnancy, because they often gain around 30 pounds or more during a pregnancy. Only about 20 pounds of that is baby and excessive fluid and placenta and so forth. So a mother would be happy to lose about 10 pounds. And if she will breastfeed, usually she will do that. Now, it may be that she will maintain her weight during the first part of her breastfeeding. That is usual, because the baby isn't taking much in the early days. But if she persists and will continue to breastfeed for about a year, in the last several months, she will lose a pound a month, just even eating as much as she would generally like to eat. And it makes a very nice way of interaction between baby and mother. Now, the psychological advantages of a slower maturation physically for the baby, we discussed yesterday in the precocious puberty epidemic that we are now having, but I would like to reemphasize that breastfed babies are not likely to be involved in this scene of rebellion and crime and drugs and alcoholism that we are seeing in the poor little babies that are force-fed and reach their generation age at a much earlier age than do those who are breastfed and then fed a vegetarian diet. In my opinion, the ideal way to feed a baby these days is to start him off with breast milk, nothing but until he is 6 months of age. At that time, start slowly to introducing a little solid food. And you may start with some kind of canned or fresh fruit, avoiding strawberries, citrus, apples, and bananas that are not dead ripe. Bananas must be chosen with great care for a baby if you're going to give bananas to an infant. They must be dead ripe, but no spoilage whatsoever. So it must be chosen very carefully. But canned pears or a very nicely ripe pear could be used. Apricots can be used. A small amount of grapes. And what I'm speaking of is maybe a teaspoonful. You do not start a six-month-old baby with a plate full of food. It's a teaspoonful of food at that time. Stick with the same food for about 5 to 7 days. And if the baby fares all right and doesn't get the colic and doesn't break out in a rash, then you know that the baby can take that all right. His digestive system has matured to the point that he can take that all right. What is the major reason for not introducing solid foods early to a baby? Allergies. The development of allergies because of the shock to the immune system from the presentation of chemicals which the body's maturation has not yet proceeded to the point that it can care for these particular chemicals. So you wait until the maturation is of such a degree that the baby can take these foods without injury. After a week or two, try another food. Again, it's just a teaspoonful or two at a meal, maybe 2 or 3 meals a day. Principle is still breastfeeding. Then after a month or two, you can perhaps add some vegetables, carrots or beets or squash or perhaps greens. And where do you get these? From Gerber's little bottles? No, you get these from your own table, the best quality that you can provide. Now you need a blender, or you need to have good muscles in your arms for working the pestle in the mortar. So you want to work with a blender. Blenders now can be obtained for under $20, and you can certainly afford one if you can afford a baby. Somebody has said that during the baby's first, 5 years, he costs an average of $21,000. Don't go into this with your eyes closed. If you cannot afford a baby, consider it a luxury and refrain from bearing children. Now, the genius of this matter of childbirth and breastfeeding is one that, as you study it, you recognize our Creator's genius. I am so thankful that we know about breastfeeding and the birth process so that it can help us to appreciate our Father's genius and His love. You see, we were planned in the Father's mind not 6,000 years ago when we were first placed on this earth. We were planned in the Father's mind eons ago. He knew about us from before the time that He started creating the world. We were planned. And I like what Ralph Martin has to say about this earth. He has a theory that the whole of the starry universe was made as a bridal, a wedding gift for His bride. The Bible describes the human race, the human family, the church, as being the bride of Christ. And Ralph Martin feels that the whole starry universe is a wedding gift for the bride of Christ. And I'm certainly disposed to believe that. The fact that the Savior made such an infinite sacrifice for our redemption is certainly an indication to us that we are precious in His sight. And when I study the precious mechanisms of physiology, I can believe that an all-wise, an infinitely wise designer thought us out very carefully. We were not in any way haphazardly produced. From yesterday, I have a number of questions, and I would like to answer those now. The first one is about fruit and its being overripe. Overripe really should be spoiled. And what did we say were the characteristics of spoilage? Number one, smell spoiled, taste spoiled, feel spoiled, and look spoiled. If it has those characteristics, then it is spoiled. But simply fully matured fruit or fully ripened fruit should not be considered overripe. Most of us have a taste for fruit when it is fully matured. Here is a question. Has cow's milk been definitely shown to be harmful to us scientifically? I'm almost surprised to see this statement. So much has been written in the last 25 years in the medical literature. Why is it that lay people do not know about this? Physicians have failed in publicizing this material that has been present for so many years in the medical literature. My husband and I wrote a small book. It has 160 pages in it. And yet in this small book, we have 248 references. This small book to the current medical literature. This book is called The Animal Connection. And if you would like to read some of the things in it concerning how cow's milk has been definitely shown to be harmful to us scientifically. It is harmful to us in every way. Its chemical composition is harmful to humans. I just told you about how it's harmful to babies. But milk raises the blood cholesterol in a human more than any other substance, any substance that we know. Milk is number one in efficiency in raising our blood cholesterol. What about allergies? 60% of all food allergies, 60% of them, from this one food alone, milk. All the other allergies that occur are from just 40. The other 40% are from all other things. Do you see the importance of milk in causing allergies? Then so far as diseases are concerned, about 15 years ago, Ralph Nader made a list of infectious diseases that can be transmitted from cows to humans that are known to be transmitted. And I think he had something like 40 or 50 diseases known to be transmitted from cattle to humans. And there are at least three serious ones that are suspected of being transmitted from cattle to humans. Cancer and several other malignancies, lymphomas and leukemias. These are strongly suspected. Just this past year, a major article published in the most prestigious of all medical journals, Lancet, carried a large article on leukemia, bovine leukemia, and its similarity to human leukemia. And there are many who believe that bovine leukemia is human leukemia. The same virus produces the same disease, just in different species. And that being in the different species, it takes a slightly different form, just as several other germs take. Then, of course, we haven't even mentioned the lactose problem, nor have we mentioned yet multicell obesity. Milk drinking sets our set point for weight control at a higher level, as do all other animal products. So, yes, indeed, there is the clearest of scientific evidence. You simply need to read the medical literature. Now, as with most things that have some kind of politico-economic reason attached to it, physicians are rather cagey and on the fence. I was told when I entered the specialty of pathology that one of the most important things that I should learn in my residency of 5 years was to how to express things from a position on the fence. And I found that to be true. That was an important thing for me to learn if I wanted to be politically successful in my profession. Here's another question. The permanent waves, the Gary curls and so forth, are they harmful or potentially harmful to hair and scalp? Well, to hair and scalp, I would consider a very minor part of what would be the dangers of any cosmetics. I would think that what happens to the blood is of more importance. And yes, those chemicals used as cosmetics on hair or skin or nails are absorbed into the bloodstream through the skin and do make the blood impure. And as some of you may know, there have been some very celebrated lawsuits involving cosmetic companies because of certain things contained within some cosmetics that have caused permanent injury to people. One was mercury some time ago. Mercury compounds were common in cosmetics. Those are no longer being used, but others that are also harmful are being used. And the sad thing about cosmetics is that it often takes 30 or 40 years before we understand that a cosmetic is causing us a problem. But by that time, tens of millions of people have been not only exposed but injured by them. And of course, with so many millions being injured, then it is considered just a fact of life and no retribution necessary. Here is a question about the set point theory as it relates to eating several types of foods at a meal. Let me just describe the set point theory, and it is a theory, as are all other theories concerning how it is that we gain weight and what it is that makes us have a certain weight, why it is that some people will not go above a certain weight no matter how much they eat, and some people cannot come below a certain weight no matter how little they eat. The set point makes some people very discouraged, but I think that it should not be a thing of discouragement. It should be a thing of investigation. What are our set points? How have we set the points? What things influence the set point? Now, of course, there are set points not only for weight, but also for height. Why is it that a man does not get to be as tall as a giraffe or as fat as an elephant? Why is it that we just stop at about 150 pounds rather than 3,000 pounds? Well, genetic factors are involved, hormonal factors, nutritional stress factors, psychologic factors, and especially exercise factors for our weight. Now, all of these things are also involved in certain other factors, such as the rate of our respiration and the level of our hemoglobin and the level of our white blood cell. All of these things are controlled by many of these things. One of the most important factors in controlling our weight is that of the diet, the composition of the diet. Composition of the diet should be, for a lower set point in your weight, it should be a vegetarian diet with the elimination of fats and sugars and several dishes at a meal. Now, this is something that is recent. I guess I've been hearing about it only about a year, so I would think that it probably is not more than a couple of years of age. And we generally comb the medical literature pretty carefully for things having to do with appetite control, since this is such an important thing. This matter of the number of dishes. Now, Seventh-day Adventists have taught for over 100 years that we should not have a great spread of dishes at our meals, that the number of dishes that we should have at our meals should range from 2 to 4, no more than 4. Now, that would be 4 dishes plus bread. 2 dishes plus bread are better for those who are overweight. And if you are sick and overweight, it may be that the mono diet, that is 1 dish plus bread, might be better for you. I would think that a little experimentation would be in order for the person's own individual makeup, chemical makeup, and nutritional needs, as to whether he would need a great deal or just a little. A great deal of varieties, meaning 4, or very few, meaning 1. I think that generally speaking, 1 meal per day is not enough for us, that we need 2 meals a day. And generally speaking, 3 meals a day are too many for us. So 2 represents the ideal number of meals for us during a day. Now, that's the first important factor influencing the set point, and that is the composition of the meals. The second important point influencing the set point for weight is, what do you suppose? Exercise. Exercise actually resets our set point at a lower rate. And it is far more important, I think, for us to concentrate on exercise than it is even to concentrate on the food, on food intake. So far as resetting our set point, I think that exercise is the most important single point. Now, when and how much is the next question. Let's take the when first. If you're trying to lose weight, when is the most important time for you to exercise? Immediately after the meal. Now, immediately after a meal, what happens if you get out and start splitting wood? You shut off your digestion. That is not helpful. So we should not have violent exercise right after a meal. something that is just moderate. What is that? No jogging right after a meal. But a walk would be all right. But again, it should not be a heavy pushing walk. It should be a little faster than a stroll, but not a really heavy pushing walk right after a meal. Now, if you're trying to gain weight, then wait a couple of hours. Have a little exercise right after the meal, such as washing dishes or doing a little cleaning up, and that would be appreciated by the housewife. Everybody got up from the table and did a little housekeeping. That does promote digestion. And then after 10 or 15 minutes, then you get out and do some heavy labor. You may wish to use those first 10 or 15 minutes to collect your tools and get to your work site. That's what we generally do in our household. I generally like to get up from the table and leave everything right where it is so that no one who is clearing away the food will be tempted to nibble if we have those who are tempted to nibble while we are putting away the food. Then we get out of the house, collect our tools, get all of our carts and various garden tools together, get to the site where we're going to work, and by the time we do all of that, some 10 or 15 minutes have gone by, and we can, if it hasn't gotten quite to that point, we can do a little mild gardening while we're waiting for the first part of the digestion to begin. If you do not wait for that point, then you will cut off digestion, which does result in fermentation. So we should not do that. All right, the next question is when you say limit the varieties at a meal, does that mean one variety being fruit or one variety being grains? And the answer is no, because then you could eat all foods that there are possible. You could eat fruits, vegetables, and whole grains ad lib with any meal. No, what it means is one fruit. That would be like peaches. And if you're going to have two fruits, you could have peaches and bananas with a cereal. Now, if you have, you know, there are bananas and there are bananas. You can get bananas that are like this, or guineos that are like this, or platanos that are like this. Those are all bananas. And I don't think that the body would be able to distinguish a great deal between the finger bananas and the arm size, arm length bananas. So to me, that would be bananas. The same thing with greens. If you're serving lettuce and turnip greens, I don't believe the body can make a great distinction between those two. So I would say limit the greens to three, the grains to three, the legumes to three. That would be like two or three forms of beans could be mixed in the same pot, and that would still just go as one. But I'm not certain that the chemical components of these various foods is close enough that we can take it beyond two or three. So I would say that a bread that contained two or three grains would be all right. But if you have a tossed salad and it contains lettuce and carrots and onions and peppers and tomatoes and garbanzos, I would not call that one dish. I would call that a complex mixture. And we should avoid complex mixtures. All right. Guess that's all of the questions. And you have I've gone a little over time. And if you wouldn't mind writing your questions down and hand those in to me, it makes it go a little faster. Right now you have a break. And I'm sorry, I have gone over time. So you have only 4.5 minutes for your break. So jump up and down a little bit and stir around a bit to get your circulation going. And then if the bell ringer would ring our bell in 4.5 minutes, please.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.